We're back on Latter Day Radio here on 1430 KLO World Class Talk. If you've been listening since the beginning, then you know what today is and what we're discussing, the official public release of the announcement and what is now called Official Declaration Number 2 at the end of the Doctrine and Covenants. It was dated June 8, 1978 and was affirmed on September the 30th, 1978 in the semi-annual session of General Conference in the Tabernacle. In part, the letter read, "He has heard our prayers and by revelation has confirmed that the long-promised day has come when every faithful, worthy man in the church may receive the Holy Priesthood with power to exercise its divine authority and enjoy with his loved ones every blessing that flows therefrom, including blessings of the temple." Since we began today, we've tracked down friends and neighbors who were adults then to learn their reaction, where they were, and what they were doing when they learned about the revelation. I'm Greg Girard, and I'm here with my neighbor and ward member and friend, Don Gull, who in 1978 was working in broadcasting in Manhattan, and later was called to be a mission president in Ireland. He heard about the announcement at High Council meeting in Scarsdale, New York. So Don, you said the priesthood revelation didn't come to you as a surprise.
It wasn't a complete surprise, but it was like even things we anticipate. When it actually happens, it is perhaps more significant than we thought it was going to be emotionally. So for me, it was a deeply touching event because I had anticipated it with joyful anticipation. I was looking forward to this happening because I worked with a lot of black people in New York. And so to not have to deal with the issue of blacks in the priesthood from the same vantage point was a relief to me. But it did open up some other challenges as to, well, then why now? You know, why didn't you do this before? And what led up to this? And why this problem over all these years? So it didn't exactly close the window. It opened some new windows, but it opened some windows of opportunity, of exploration that might not have occurred otherwise. One of the deepest regrets of my life was a meeting I had with a banker who was black. At CBS, I was very young. I was in my late 20s, and I was responsible for banking relations for CBS, and I met with this banker who was black one day, and he asked me the question, "Why are blacks not allowed to hold the priesthood in your church?" And I gave him the pat answer that had been taught to me, over the years, and I didn't know really why, but it was the wrong answer. And it simply was not the truth. And I can't tell you how many times the deep regret down in my soul, burns up, bubbles up, and how many times that's occurred over all these years. And if I could turn back the clock, I thought, is there some way I could ever find him and sit down and talk with him and try to explain to him the changes that have taken place and tell him how much I regret it. I would imagine from that conversation that he would have never joined the church because of what I said, deep regret. So that was an element of the joy that I received when I knew that the blacks could have the priesthood and all worthy males could have the priesthood throughout the world. And I thought, oh, if I could turn back the clocks and say, join the church and let's get you the priesthood, you know.
Enjoy the blessings.
Enjoy the blessings of the priesthood.
Now, as time went on, you had some challenges and responsibilities as a very young man in Ireland. Tell us how this opening up of the blessings to these people, this particular group of people, helped the growth of the church overall. Because in my perspective, it wasn't just the people of color that benefited from this revelation, but the church as a whole. We have 16 million people today. And the growth of the church can be partly attributed to the fact that we're an inclusive, universal church.
I think that's true. In Ireland, there, you know, as a portion of the population, there are very few blacks.
Right.
But I remember the impression that I had of the potential of the growth of the church among black people occurred at a mission president's conference in London late 1986, and then another one in 1987. And at that time, mission presidents from Africa were part of our area. And so they would meet with us in London. And I remember these mission presidents talking about literal villages coming into the church, that the village elder would say, "We're going to be Mormons." And of course, everybody became Mormon. And 2 weeks later, he'd say, "Well, I don't like the Mormons anymore." So, you know, so away went that congregation. And there was some issues of, you know, how do we get our arms around that?
How do we assimilate these people and teach them leadership principles?
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Because it's a little bit like the challenge of China. If the gospel goes over that country like a wave, you know, what do you do with 10,000 people a week joining the church who've been communists? Well, in a way, it's like a lot of people, black people, who have been raised in a completely different culture. All of a sudden, someone's an elders quorum president, and they say, "What's an elders quorum president?" You know, they don't have a clue what that means. Whereas to us, it's just part of our upbringing. But for them, it's completely new. How do you assimilate them? How do you train them to administer the affairs of the church in the right way? So a big challenge, but the growth of the church today is explosive in Africa. I work as a sealer in the temple, and there are black families that come to the temple all the time. And I look at them with joy. I look at them and see these dignified, wonderful people there in the temple where there was a time in my life when they could not have entered.
You know that?
And it could not give me a greater sense of peace and optimism for them and for the church generally. And I suspect we'll see key leadership positions in the church being occupied by blacks more and more and more as time goes by. So it has a significant impact, and will continue to have a significant impact on the growth and development of the church.
So, Don, are there some parallels between taking the gospel to a place like China and making priesthood blessings available to blacks and people of African descent?
I don't know that the barrier would be the same, or that people would consider there being any kind of barrier to priesthood, receiving the priesthood in China, because it would never have been withheld from a worthy male in China.
But they're withheld from the gospel by government policies. So
right.
is that a similar? That's, guess what I'm getting at.
Well, it's more than that, if I may say.
Okay.
It is a culture. It's inbred in them. I can remember having a conversation with a young woman that my wife and I came to know very well. And she was a communist, and she said to us at this lunch one day, "You have something we don't have." "What's that?" she said. "You have an anchor. We have no anchor." And the anchor, of course, was that we had the church, we had the gospel, we had something to hold on to that was more than just a belief. In her mind, it was an anchor, and we can see the. We can see the imagery of an anchor in a ship, you know, holding it fast to the ocean floor so that it's not blown about by the winds and the waves and so on. And I can remember in 1987, again, going back to the times of mission president conferences in London, Elder Nelson had come back from Beijing on his way back to Salt Lake, had stopped in London and met with mission presidents. And he talked about the Chinese and the virtues of China. And he said, "The time will come in which the gospel will go over that country like a wave." And he waved his hand in front of him, will go over that country like a wave. And I can remember thinking about that as we met with these Chinese people. And I would find lots of opportunities to talk about gospel principles, and found them deeply touched by these gospel principles. They sensed the truth of it. Their souls sensed the truth of it. And I thought, I can't wait for the day in which that prophecy, that I believe was a prophecy by the future president of the church, would come to be. And hope that some way I could participate in that. I don't know that I will, but I'm virtually certain the time will come in which the gospel will go through that country like a wave. And the challenge will be how to not just convert these people to the principles of the gospel, but culturally how to convert them to how to administer the affairs of the church. And to some extent, how do we become converted to them? It's not just a matter of them being converted to the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's the church adapting things like buildings. Mm-hmm. We think we have to have a Wasatch Front, building in Tianjin, China, or in Guangzhou. We don't have to have that. We do things their way. It doesn't affect the gospel at all. So I think we're going to see a lot of adaptation in Africa, in China, in these large populations, and whatever happens to the Muslim world. You think about that, an awful lot of Muslims in the world. We're talking about over 1 billion people. So there's going to have to be some adaptation on our part in order to assimilate these people into the church that won't in any way affect the living of the gospel and the fulfillment of the oath and covenant of the priesthood among these people. So I see a lot of change that will take place in the church and in these cultures in order to have the world, literally the entire world, hear and receive the gospel of Christ.
Thank you. Coming to the end of our segment here, but I would just say one thing. When the hand of the Lord takes a hold of our fate and destiny, we can expect that he knows what he's doing and he's anticipating how we'll react to it.
And that brings us to the end of our broadcast for today. You've been listening to 1430 KLO World Class Talk. I'm Greg Girard for Latter-day Radio. We'll see you next Friday.